Let me begin this session. This is we're going to be looking at methodology, and really we don't have a lot of material to cover, so I'd like to just briefly, and I'm going to kind of race through this. I hope it doesn't bother anyone, but I do think it's worth even racing through just to get a sample of the founders of modern science and just get a sense of all that we just looked at in the last session. Remember, again, the issue here is that modern scientific methodology was born out of a Christian worldview. So let's look at some examples. We've talked about Johann Kepler, founder of astronomical physics. He actually corrected and extended Copernicus, Tycho Brahe, and Galileo. He was a Puritan who took on, again, a Reformed view and corrected the mathematics and other features. In fact, Copernicus had perfect circles. And it was Kepler who said, no, the orbits are not in perfect circles. They're actually elliptical. He spent 2 years in seminary, was going to be a minister of the gospel, and he's the one who first coined thinking God's thoughts after him. Kepler said this, since we astronomers are priests of the highest God in regard to the book of nature. Did you guys hear that? Since we are priests of the highest God in regard to volume 2, the book of nature, it befits us to be thoughtful, not of the glory of our minds, but rather, above all else, of the glory of God. Creation exists to make much not of creation, but of Christ, the Creator. Johann Kepler got it, and he gave us astronomical physics. Isaac Newton, well known, probably one of the greatest scientists in the last 2,000 years. Remember, he said himself, he stood on the shoulders of giants. He gave much to Francis Bacon and others before him in the Royal Society. He came out of, again, a Protestant worldview. He is the one who founded the discipline of physics for us. He's noted with gravitational forces as articulating them finally scientifically. He was one of the great inventors of calculus. He also gave us Algebra 2. He really started the scientific discipline of optics. He was the first to split the ray of sun into different colors. He gave us mechanics, and he built the reflective telescope. So many contributions to him, from him, it's innumerable. This is what he said. This most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent being. This being governs all things, not as the soul of the world, but as Lord over all. You see the Reformed Christian worldview giving rise to scientific methodology because God is sovereign over all. And so he says, and on account of his dominion, he is wont to be called Lord God or universal ruler. The supreme God is a being eternal, infinite, absolute, perfect. And then he says this, in case you think he did not show respect to God's volume 1. We account the scriptures of God to be the most sublime philosophy. I find more sure marks of authenticity in the Bible than in any profane history whatsoever. It doesn't sound like Peter Atkins is correct when he says that religion and science cannot be reconciled. Probably one of the greatest scientists in the last 2,000 years. And he says, the scriptures are the perfect revelation. And creation is only second. How about Robert Boyle? Some claim that he would have been much more popular if he didn't live at the same time as Newton. Unfortunately, Newton overshadowed other great scientists of the same time. Boyle is one of them. This guy I loved. I actually studied both of them extensively in college. And Boyle gave us fluid dynamics, pneumatics, all the gas theories. He's the founder of modern physics. He was the formal founder of the Royal Society, took Bacon's work and established the institution. He also funded, and this is amazing, there's documentation that he took massive amounts of his income. He actually lived a very modest life, but he had lots of money that was given to the church, the Puritan church, for the sake of missions and Bible translation. So he funded Bible translation, and he was passionate for gospel missions. In fact, he gave lectures as a scientist. He gave lectures on the importance of gospel missions. Remember last night I mentioned there are four major concerns, and one of them is global missions. When we get this right, we'll get a heart for the need that the sovereign God over all creation deserves to be praised, and people must and should and would delight to come to him. He gave Boyle lectures, and in these lectures, a series of highly academic and highly scientific and very intellectual defenses of Christianity. He was dealing with some of the beginning descent of the Enlightenment. John Ray, another great scientist father, he's an English natural history. In fact, he's the founder of the Natural History Museum idea in England and London. He is one of the other founding members of the Royal Society. He gave us the modern disciplines of biology. He is also known as the father of zoology. He was also in natural theology himself. He came up with taxonomies. In fact, I'll just show that to you. He wrote a book. One of his most influential books was not on science. The most influential book was this one, The Wisdom of God Manifested in the Works of Creation. This was a great work. And he was a writer, voluminous, in fighting deism. And if you note the dates, this is before, this country was established as a nation and deism had infiltrated. So he was fighting deism back then. Here we have Linnaeus. This is the one I was going to refer to, kind of picks up on John Ray. He becomes the father of biological taxonomy, which means he is the one who gave rise to typology, identifying that there are certain types and structures in the biological world that are distinct. So evolution and the idea of a tree of life, where all diversity comes from one little stem, an amoeba, he says, no, it's more like, in fact, that didn't happen yet. But his view was typology, and the science of it is built on the idea that it's a forest. All kinds of different lives are planted, and there's variation within them, but they're all distinctly planted. Not one tree that gives rise to all diversity, but a forest of trees that have minor diversity between in them. So he is the founding father of that. He gave us botany, and he also contributed to zoology and natural theology. Michael Faraday, another one of my favorites. Each one of these have writings on theology and the scriptures. In fact, by the end of Sir Isaac Newton's life, he actually wrote more on theology than he did on science. Not all of his theology was very good, but he did write more on theology than science. Michael Faraday is a very, very interesting man. I would say, again, if you have a cell phone and you touch it, or if you enjoy any of these electronics, you can really give thanks to the discoveries through Michael Faraday. He was the one who discovered electromagnetic induction. So through that, we get electromagnetic capacitance. The capacitor was founded by him. Induction, the principles of the transformer, started from him. He's the one who invented the generator and the alternator. He's the one who gave us electrolysis and electrostatus. These are forms of chemistry and understanding transformation. In fact, when I was in the laboratory at IBM, we were working, not my team, but another team in the C wing. I was in the E wing. In the C wing, they were working on a chemical processor, a computational processor that wasn't semiconductor dealing with electrons, but it was chemical based upon Faraday's discoveries. Even capacitance. If you get a capacitor today and you look on the side, it'll say something like, 100 MF. And the M is for micro, and it could be a different symbol, but the F is for farad. So farad, the unit of capacitance, is named after Michael Faraday. But it's not just about his scientific discoveries, because this is what he says. The Bible and it alone, with nothing added to it nor taken away from it by man, is the sole and sufficient guide for each individual at all times and in all circumstances. Faith in the divinity and work of Christ is the gift of God, and the evidence of this faith is obedience to the commandment of Christ. You know that Michael Faraday, for a time, lived in London and was a lay pastor of a Methodist church. He actually would pastor the church while he was off in his garage doing experiments. That's amazing. Samuel Morse. You know him from the Morse code. You know him from the telegraph. He is the inventor of the telegraph. And most people don't know, he was the one who built the very first camera in America. He also took the very first photographic portrait ever in the world. He is the one who was influenced under Timothy Dwight at Yale, who was the son-in-law of Jonathan Edwards. He had a theology that was very strong, very profound. The very first message that was ever sent by a telegraph, the very first message ever sent by any technology means, was this message in 1844 by Samuel Morse, which stated, "What hath God wrought?" Not what, how great I am or my technology or invention, but what hath God wrought? Look at what Samuel Morse said. "The nearer I approach the end of my pilgrimage, the clearer is the evidence of the divine origin of the Bible. The grandeur and sublimity of God's remedy for fallen man are more appreciated, and the future is illumined with hope and joy." These men who were great founders of science were men who loved and adored God and found in their worldview hope in Christ. Lord Kelvin, one of my absolute favorites, I could spend a long time on him. I have several books on Kelvin. I love him because in physics, I dealt with thermodynamics quite extensively, and he is the father of thermodynamics. He possessed 21 doctorates, 21 honorary doctorates. Okay, you don't get that by just peddling around with science. This is a guy who contributed massive paradigm shift thought in the world of science in Europe at the time. He came up with nearly all of the fundamental principles of energy, all of which, by the way, we would not have had Albert Einstein able to do what he did if it wasn't for Lord Kelvin. In fact, Einstein comments and exalts Kelvin often. Kelvin gives us the absolute measure of energy or temperature. He also came up with marine instruments. He also came up with the transatlantic means of communication between the continent of Europe and the continent of North America. And he said this, "With regard to the origin of life, science positively affirms creative power." He actually fought, and if you notice his age, he lived through the Darwin Age. He lived through the publication in 1859 of The Origin of Species, and he wrote, as a man of incredible, impeccable reputation in science, he wrote passionately against Darwin. James Clerk Maxwell, another one that I studied as studying magnetism, this is the father largely of electrodynamics. We get magnetism from that. We get speakers from that. We get, again, electric motors. We get all sorts of things today, transducers of all types, heat mechanisms, all from his work in electrodynamics. He also did extensive work in magnetic flux, discoveries in the Earth magnetic flux itself, as well as in induced magnetic flux. He came up with control theory. So many wonderful contributions that gave us the means for all sorts of technology today, including the automobile. Much of it is attributed back to James Clerk Maxwell. And he said, "I believe with the Westminster divines and the predecessors ad infinitum that man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever." In fact, I wish I could quote more of him because he has so much that he wrote about the glory of Christ. It's marvelous and beautiful. He also wrote against Darwinism as well. He lived through that period. We find also Joseph Lister. You know him from Listerine. Listerine comes from Joseph Lister, who was the founder of antiseptics and the founder of antiseptic surgery. He was the president of the Royal Society, and he was opposed by many because back in his day, alchemy was the idea to cure a problem. And alchemy is simply an old word that it describes the transmutation from one thing to the next. It's what you do to metals to change them. And the idea was, you know, you boil up something and you have someone drink it and see if that makes them better. I mean, that's not very good science. Or you purge George Washington's blood until he dies. That's not very good science. He was in an era where he had to fight that, and he fought that on principles of, again, his own conviction with the Christian worldview. He said, "I am a believer in the fundamental doctrines of Christianity." He has much else to say, but there are some beautiful things to see in the Christian worldview. Louis Pasteur, amazing contributions from him, the founder of medical microbiology. He is he's the one who gave us bacteriology, the study of bacteria itself. He's the one who discovered bacteria. We know them as germs. He's the one who came up with a theory of how to pasteurize and deal with the development of bacteria in milk before there were refrigerators. So he came up with a process to pasteurize in certain liquids that would form bacteria that would cause them to spoil and go bad and make people sick. He discovered how that happened. He also was employed, if you notice his dates, he lived through the Darwin era, and he was actively employed by France to do some investigation to try to prove Darwin's theory of evolution and somehow come up with the idea of biogenesis, the beginning of life. Well, he did. He worked on spontaneous generation. And what he did, because back then they thought, see, that the idea that things would just come from blobs. They didn't have an understanding of life. So when meat was left out, maggots would form. And they thought that just happened spontaneously. When water was left in a pond, all these little creatures would be found moving around. They thought that just happened. So you know what Pasteur did? He says, all right, let me prove this. It's not going to happen. He took a glass ball. He put water in it, distilled water. And then after he distilled the water, he then took and heated the neck of the ball. And he bent the neck of the ball and he made it into an S. And then he filled the neck over here with distilled water and he left it. What that did was it created an airtight chamber that was sealed by glass of distilled water in the ball. He let that stand for 3 days, was what all the scientists thought. In 3 days, you're going to start seeing life form in there spontaneously. No life in 3 days. A week goes by, no life. 2 weeks, no life. 3 weeks, no life. Not a single thing developed in the water after 3 weeks. And he published his work, and he gave all these evidential reasons explaining the reason why you see life coming out of meat is because flies had actually impregnated the meat with eggs. And he proved that theory by covering it with cheesecloth and putting the meat out and disallowing the flies to land on the meat. And sure enough, the meat spoiled, went bad, but there were no maggots. And repeatedly he showed you cannot get life from a blob of cytoplasm and spontaneously find life there. Well, he said a lot of things. He said, the more I study nature, the more I stand amazed at the work of the Creator. He said, a little science takes you away from God, but more of it takes you to Him. And you know that he was a scientist, and you know that Charles Darwin was not. Some will try to disagree with me. He was not a scientist. We'll get into that in the next session. Science brings men nearer to God, Pasteur says. So here we have, again, just a sampling of the founding fathers of science. And one quote from, of all people, the former Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Margaret Thatcher. She said an incredibly wise statement. Look at this. In the context of science, if you try to take the fruits of Christianity without its roots, the fruits will wither and they will not come again unless you nurture the roots. You know what that means? There's an acknowledgement that modern science came from Christianity, and now you want to take the fruit of that and chop the root. It's going to wither and die and collapse on you, and science will not be the great God you think it is. So you must go back and nurture the roots. That's why this conference, to nurture the roots, that indeed there might be some God-honoring, God-centered science. Thank you for allowing me to go through that. Took much longer than I thought. So we'll speed through the next. Science. Let's go through the scientific method. Here we go. Together. Watch this. It's wonderful. The scientific method is composed of these six basic steps. You can reduce them down, but I'll use this for the sake of illustration. This is the method that I was taught. This is the method that I used in a laboratory. When you deal with applicational science, operational science, empirical science, you're dealing with a method that walks through a series of inductive principles. First, problem, observation, hypothesis, deduction, experimentation, then conclusion. Now, with this in mind, let me just show you, and I'll leave this up so you can copy them, but let me show you how each of these line up rationally. First, we have this. Objectively, it's observable. So the scientific method starts with an objective premise. It cannot be an inference or an assumption. It must be something that you observe. Origins cannot be observed. Whether you're Christian or you're atheist, you cannot call a theory of origins science. That's not science in the narrow sense of empiricism. First and foremost, we have to understand we may have a problem with trying to figure out where we came from, but you cannot use this method to explain it, because this method first depends upon an observable objectivity. Secondly, it depends upon reliable reproducibility. An experiment means you take in a deduction, so you might use a form of a syllogism. I've looked upon the problem. The problem might be that, let's use the case of Darwin. So the problem is the finch birds. Why do they have different sized beaks? That's our problem. Our observation is we look at them and we see that the finch birds with the longer beaks can actually reach deeper into the crevice of the crack on the rock. So we can observe that. Then we hypothesize. This is where we come up with a theory, an assumption. And we say, well, I think it's because XYZ. Darwin thought it was because of evolution, natural selection. And indeed, it is natural selection is partly the issue, and that's science. We'll get to that in the next session. So the key then, as I hypothesize, now I walk through the deduction. If this, then this, let me set up my apparatus and testing, and let's begin the experiment. That was never done. But if you could do that, you would experiment to see if indeed successive generations would change their beaks based upon the conditions. And by the way, there was an article put out a couple years ago, very interesting, Nature magazine put it out, celebrating the Galapagos. They found again a drought season at the Galapagos, and the finch birds' beaks were growing. What's interesting is they cut out all of the data because they didn't include the very next season. Which the very next season, I think it was 2008, the very next season, there was a flood season. And there was an abundance of water. And guess what? The next year, the finches with small beaks came back. But nature didn't want to mention that, because it would be part of closing back to a hypothesis and saying, maybe not. So, reliable reproducibility. Can you reproduce your hypothesis? Secondly, our next here, empirical experimentation. This means you've got to be able to interact with it tangibly. You've got to measure it. You've got to be able to quantify and observe with your eyes or touch and so forth. You've got to have an empirical access to the experiment. Next, we find that the conclusion must be based upon repeated results. If the hypothesis is to be supported by science, otherwise, it's just another Aristotelian deduction. If it's to be supported by science, it must be repeatable and consistently repeatable. You should be able to publish a theory based upon and give the conditions that by which you can reproduce the same results. Next, you should also have the subject to critique. Now, this is important, and I'll mention it here, falsifiable. The idea is, this is the great problem in science, and I experienced it myself, was that often the reports are very selective. And the way that the nature of the study goes is you get massive amounts of data, all kinds of experimental data, and you have to sift through them, and it's too much for us to go through, right? It's too much for anyone to go through. So what often happens is you scan, like you're scanning through a good book to find a juicy part, you scan through, and you land on something that is in favor of your hypothesis. And you camp on that. And you do all you can to try to get those results again. And that's what you report. That's not being subject to critique. And stepping further, Karl Popper, which I have documented here on page 37, contributed the idea that this is the problem with science by the time of Karl Popper in 1930. By the time from Sir Francis Bacon to the 1930s, Darwin had shown up and lots of science had started going crazy. All these hypotheses that weren't substantiated, weren't verified. Karl Popper comes on, who's not a Christian. He was an agnostic Jew. And he says, there's a problem here. Science is not being used right. So he wrote an entire book on the matter, and he challenged the scientific community to say, listen, your problem is this. You approach, you look at the problem, you do your observations, you come up with a hypothesis, but the way you go about your study, your experiment, is you're selectively angling towards supporting it. He says, what you need to do is experiment in the opposite direction, trying to disprove it. Instead of selectively looking for the information that supports your hypothesis, why don't you look for the information that disproves it? That's called falsifiability. That's a very important principle in reliable science. That's actually what is done to build bridges, to make sure that they don't collapse, is you try to find the weak point. You try to find and falsify the formula. Because if it's possible that it could be in some way deficient, people die. So you look at that angle. But when you come up with theories of origin, you're only going to be looking for the things that prove your hypothesis. And that's not science. All right. Notice this, subjectively perceived the problem. What's left then are these three things. If you look at the contrast, look at those, point two, and then five and six. And now we have what's left is point one, three, and four. And these are all subjective. It's something perceived, something purported, and something presumed. This is Aristotelian science. No experimentation. And so forth. This, by the way, is origins observed. No. Does anyone think origins is observed? We can take a break. Can origins be experimented? No. Is the conclusion of origins something that can be falsified? No. So based upon this criteria, we find that it's a subjective conclusion that is reduced to Aristotelian form of what is so-called science. So if we are to be honest with the methodology of modern science, we must be more rigorous. Let's consider now, let me just do this briefly, and we're going to be done soon, Lord willing. Let me go through a couple of quotes here. Pseudoscience from Oxford says it's a pretended or spurious science, a collection of related beliefs about the world mistakenly regarded as being based on scientific method. You hear that? Somebody's got to be excited. You guys hear that? Right? Look at this. A pseudoscience is something that is mistakenly regarded as being based on scientific method, calling it science when it's not based on scientific method. That's pseudoscience. Or as having the status of the scientific truths now have. This, beloved and friends, is why I am making the case that evolution is not science. I'm making the case on the basis of definition, on the basis of scientific methodology. It is a pseudoscience at very best. Ernest Mayr, an evolutionary biologist of Harvard, just died a few years ago, but he said this, laws and experiments are inappropriate techniques for the explication of such events and processes. Evolution. Really? Laws and experiments, that's science. That's inappropriate for explaining evolution? Instead, one constructs a historical narrative, sounds like philosophy, consisting of a tentative reconstruction of the particular scenario that led to the events one is trying to explain. Doesn't sound like science to me. He also said, laws give way in Darwinism. Evolution cannot be reduced to the laws and theories of the physical sciences. Well, Birch and Ehrlich also say this. They're evolutionary biologists writing in Nature magazine, our theory of evolution has become one which cannot be refuted by any possible observation. That sounds like it's quite nicely protected. Every conceivable observation can be fitted into it. Sounds like a presupposition to me. No one can think of ways in which to test it. Ideas either without basis or based on a few laboratory experiments carried out in extremely simplified systems have attained currency far beyond their validity. at least they're honest, and I thank God for that, they have become part of an evolutionary dogma accepted by most of us as part of our training. These are some of the biggest, highest profile scientists who promote evolution. So with that in mind, let's look now at the limitations of science. You'll notice on page 39, by the way, on page 39, I have this is as of 2018, the class 109 biological evolution from UC Santa Cruz, from their syllabus. I quote that syllabus. You can look at that later. I'd also encourage you to read page 38, Karl Popper's arguments against pseudoscience. But for right now, I really would like us to go to page 41 and consider the limitations of science. They are very important to understand. Dave Breese gives us a great synopsis. He says, the status of being scientific is so desired today that the word science has been inflated to the point that it is assumed that science knows it all and can tell us anything. Our society has come to assume that the source of all knowledge is science. Once a thing is established as being scientific, it moves beyond debate and becomes an article of faith. That is what happens. And it's amazing to me how often Americans follow along. Sir Peter Medawar says this, a Nobel laureate, there is no quicker way, and I love this. He gave this address to young scientists. He says, there is no quicker way for a scientist to bring discredit upon himself and upon his profession than roundly to declare, particularly when no declaration of any kind is called for, that science knows, or soon will know, the answers to all questions worth asking. He's saying there's limitations to science. It can't answer every question. He goes on, and that questions which do not admit scientific answer are in some way non-questions or pseudo-questions that only simpletons ask and only the gullible profess to be able to answer. Let me translate. He basically says, listen, students of science, don't you dare assume that science has all the answers, and don't take on an arrogance that tells people, if you're asking questions that I can't answer with science, then those questions are irrelevant. Those are pseudo questions. They're not real questions. They're not important questions. Science has all the real questions, all the real answers. Only gullible people ask those kind of questions, like, where did we come from? Stephen Hawking, the physicist, you know, great supporter, advocate of the Big Bang, who just recently passed. He stated this. Listen to these words in light of what we just learned. Traditionally, these are questions for philosophy, questions of where we came from. But philosophy is dead. Oh, it has not kept up with modern developments in science, particularly in physics. Of course, a physicist would say that. As a result, scientists have become the bearers of the torch of discovery in our quest for knowledge. Did you hear what he said, beloved and friends? Science is dead. I mean, philosophy is dead. He's saying, you don't need to go beyond science. He's saying exactly what we were just warned not to do. Science has all the answers. We don't need philosophy. Albert Einstein disagrees with him. He said, I fully agree with you. That this isn't obviously the same time. Einstein said this decades ago. I fully agree with you about the significance and education value of methodology, as well as history and philosophy. You hear this? A great scientist saying, I agree the need of philosophy, the need for education in other disciplines. He says, as well as history and philosophy of science. So many people today, and even professional scientists, seem to me like someone who has seen thousands of trees but has never seen a forest. In other words, these scientists walk around, all they know about is their very specialized little area. They don't know history, they don't know science or philosophy, they don't know the other disciplines, they certainly don't know theology. And it reminds me, in science, this is what's happening today, you know, specialization is champion today. There aren't very many scientific areas of work that are general. Almost every area now in a laboratory is specialized. Everyone has to be a specialist. You know what that means? You learn more and more about less and less. That's what it means. You learn more and more about less and less. Let's take that to its logical extent. You know everything about nothing. That's what it does. So you go. You go to the point where you know less and less, narrow, more and more and more I know. Specialization can be dangerous. And Einstein pointed this out. He goes on right here. A knowledge of the historic and philosophical background gives that kind of independence from prejudices and his generation from which most scientists are suffering. You hear what he's saying? He's saying when a scientist doesn't know the philosophical underpinnings of his science, he will not be a good scientist. He will begin to drift and he will begin to have prejudices. This independence created by philosophical insight is, in my opinion, the mark of distinction between a mere artisan or a specialist and a real seeker after truth. See, Einstein saw that science should be a means of seeking truth, not a means of artisanship, making much of yourself and your art and your ability and what you can contribute. It should be a means to seek truth. Etienne Gilson says this, philosophy is the only rational knowledge by which both science and nature can be judged. By reducing philosophy to pure science, man has abdicated his right to judge nature. I think that's right. When you take away the metaphysical, the non-physical prerequisites to science, you've taken away the right to do science. You can't do it. Francis Collin, a physician and geneticist, wrote a book called The Language of God, who did an extensive study on the DNA molecule. He says, science is powerless to answer questions such as why did the universe come into being? What is the meaning of human existence? What happens after we die? Science cannot answer these questions. This is a limitation of science. So let's look at that, those limitations, and write them down on 42. Number one, you cannot know the ultimate meaning of things like life. Science cannot know the ultimate meaning of life. Science is never, cannot be used. It was never designed to be used as a means to answer philosophy, metaphysics. It cannot tell us why. It is a means to explain how or what, but not why. Can't give us meaning. Oops, sorry. Oh, I guess I'm going to give you a couple quotes here on this idea of meaning. Aldous Huxley wrote some pretty striking comments about meaning. We are living now, he's the brother of another Huxley, who's the grandson, great-grandson of Thomas Huxley, and he was a friend of Darwin. So, evolutionist. He says, we are living now not in the delicious intoxication induced by the early successes of science. He's agreeing that in the Reformation, science was delicious, intoxicating in the Christian worldview. But in a rather grisly morning after, when it has become apparent that what triumphant science has done hitherto is to improve the means of achieving unimproved or actually deteriorated ends. What he's saying in kind of eloquent language is what once was wonderful and delicious and intoxicating in the Christian worldview, this wonderful flourishing science, new disciplines developing and flourishing. Well, now we've borrowed the fruits of that, and now we've woken up the morning after, and what we're finding out is all that wonder was only a means to now science being a detrimental end, a deteriorating end, a dead end. It's not helping society like we thought it would today, like it was back then. Look at what else he says. Since the time of Galileo, scientists have admitted, sometimes explicitly, but much more often by implication, that they are incompetent to discuss such matters. The scientific picture of the world is what it is because men of science combine this incompetence with certain special competencies. A way of saying they're just specialists, but they're really incompetent. They're incompetent to talk on matters that they're asked because they're highly specialized in various particular areas that are not being asked. They have no right to claim that this product of incompetence and specialization is a complete picture of reality. So don't allow a microbiologist to tell you what reality is. As a matter of historical fact, however, this claim has constantly been made. He finally says, in recent years, many men of science have come to realize that the scientific picture of the world is a partial one, the product of their special competence in mathematics and their special incompetence to deal systematically with aesthetics, beauty, and moral values, religious experiences, and intuitions of significance. That's our first point, isn't it? Cannot know the meaning. Science cannot know meaning. Two, it cannot know history. Operational science cannot give answers to history. Three, it cannot know origins. If it cannot know history, it cannot know origins. Science, operational science, empirical science, applicational science is limited to observation. It can't go back in time, and therefore it can't deal with origins. Four, it cannot know the reason why. It can't know the ultimate meaning. And it can't know the reason behind anything. It can't know why something functions a certain way. It can explain how our joints work, but it can't explain why. We can infer it benefits us this way or that. This is a major issue when we talk about vestigial organs. Why are they there? Let's cut them all out. And then we find out, actually, there were reasons for them we didn't know. Cannot say, science, operational science, cannot, number five, say what ought to be. It cannot give a moral imperative. That's not what science does. It's a limitation of science. You can't go there. Let me give us a few quotes as we near our conclusion. Albert Einstein said that aesthetics and religious instincts are tributary forms in helping the reasoning faculties toward its highest achievements. You are right in speaking of the moral foundations of science, but you cannot turn round and speak of the scientific foundations of morality. You hear what he said? That's wonderful what he said. What he just said was, you're right to say that science came out of the Christian worldview, out of a system that can explain morals and absolutes and laws of logic and uniformity. You're right to say that. You're right to say that science came from morals, but you cannot then turn it around and say that morals come from science. Every attempt to reduce ethics to scientific formulae must fail. He got it. He understood it. This is another physicist who is an adamant evolutionist, but he says this: ethical values lie outside the scientific realm. It's true. Sir Julian Huxley says, the first point to make about Darwin's theory is that it is no longer a theory but a fact. In light of all we just said, it's no longer a theory but a fact. Darwinism has come of age, so to speak. We no longer have to bother about establishing the fact of evolution. And so Peter Atkin says that it's like the child has grown and cut the apron strings. And he's also illustrated that Christianity was the chrysalis, but we're now a butterfly of science, and we do away with the chrysalis. That's the illustrations they use. That's how Sir Julian Huxley talks. And it is contradictory. If you follow the flow of the logical argument that I'm building, I brought us to a point of, let's look at what science is, the method. Let's see how scientists honestly report and understand that and agree that science has limits. And then now let's see the irrational, absurd conclusions of some. Clearly motivated not by science or the pursuit of truth, but motivated by an agenda, motivated by a worldview that has something at stake. And so it is they promote things like this, saying it's not even a theory. Are you kidding me? It's fact. Or we hear like Fleming, who says this, who's a real scientist, we completely reject the theory of evolution. In fact, I love this. Agassiz is here, Louis, French scientist of yesteryear. He's considered by some to be one of the greatest physicists that America has ever had. And he actually wrote pretty extensively against evolution, though he wasn't a Christian. We find also in Nature magazine an article that says, even if all the data, now think about the contradictions I'm showing you. Science is a fact, not even to be questioned. On the next voice, even non-Christian voice, we don't accept evolution at all. It's not science. Next voice we find back in Nature, even if all the data point to intelligent designer, such an hypothesis is excluded from science because it is not naturalistic. We can't go there. We're not going to allow God in the door. In fact, that's what we get right here from Richard Lewontin. He says this, we take the side of science in spite of the apparent absurdity. He understands the definition. In spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs, in spite of its failure to fulfill many of its extravagant promises, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories. Why? Because we have a prior commitment, a commitment to materialism. Moreover, that materialism is an absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. Bottom line. Why is it that you would say, after all this understanding of what the method of science is, after understanding the limits of science, that then you would go on to say, but we side with it anyway. We side with a theory that's not even scientific. Why? That's why. Because there's a prior commitment to not allow the divine foot in the door. Sir Arthur Keith, anatomist and anthropologist, who wrote the foreword or the preface to the 100-year anniversary of Darwin's Origin of Species. This is the 1959 version. A big celebration took place in London. He was there and he presented the book and he proudly stated this, evolution is unproved and unprovable. We believe it only because the only alternative is special creation, and that is unthinkable. Beloved and friends, I'm not here to try to make fun of people who can't defend themselves. That's not good. That's really not. What I'm here to do is to really ask you to think critically. Do you see and understand these pursuits are not because of science? It's because of a pre-commitment and a burning desire within their worldview. They have too much to lose, namely, accountability. In fact, watch this. Richard Dawkins himself says this. It is absolutely safe to say that if you meet someone who claims to not to believe in evolution, that person is ignorant, stupid, or insane, or wicked. But I'd rather not consider that. This is probably one of the most vocal atheists of our day, writing books like The God Delusion. And he's basically coming with an ad hominem, in a form of an intimidation fallacy, to try to scare you into believing and never challenging him and the view of evolution. Because there's something to lose. Let's look at that. Here's what it is. Sir Arthur Keith says, let me say that the conclusion I have come to is this. The law of Christ is incompatible with the law of evolution as far as the law of evolution has worked hitherto. Nay, the two laws are at war with each other. Doesn't sound like science to me. Sounds like theology and philosophy. The law of Christ can never prevail until the law of evolution is destroyed. This man is an ardent evolutionist. Michael Ruse, he explains it very clear. I so thank God for intellectual honesty like this. Evolution is promulgated as an idea. He's an evolutionist by far, but I appreciate the honesty. Evolution is promulgated as an ideology, a secular religion, a full-fledged alternative to Christianity. Not just religion, not an alternative to Buddhism or an alternative to Confucianism, but an alternative to Christianity, the very mother of science. In fact, did you know that theology by the Puritans was called the queen of science? The study of Scripture was called the queen of science because they saw that from this gave the queen gave birth to the children called science. So, a full-fledged alternative to Christianity with meaning and morality. Really? Evolution has meaning and morality? I'm not sure I'd like that kind of meaning and morality. I am an ardent evolutionist and an ex-Christian. He grew up, if you do some reading on Michael Ruse, it's a very sad story, one that should make you cry and cause knots in your stomach. He grew up in a fundamentalist Baptist church, and he was told, believe Genesis, don't question it. And he was told that bones in the ground were put there by the devil, and he was told that that science is evil, it's the works of the devil, and it's all supernaturally implanted. Don't ever give your mind to it. You must throw your brains away in this category and just blindly follow Christianity. Don't ever do that. It really hurts to read his story. So he says, I'm an ardent evolutionist and an ex-Christian. I would beg to differ. He's an ex-fundamentalist. But I must admit that in this one complaint, and Mr. Gish, who's a creationist, is but one of many to make it, the literalists are absolutely right. Evolution is a religion. This was true of evolution in the beginning, and it is true of evolution still today. Evolution, therefore, came into being as a kind of secular ideology, an explicit substitute for Christianity. So let's close with this. These quotes, by the way, can be found in 45 and 46. With the Humanist Manifesto, perhaps you don't know this, but the humanism of today, the institution of humanism, this was the first manifesto published in 1933, and Article 1, and I quote it in full, Article 1 of the Humanist Manifesto states, religious humanists regard the universe as self-existing and not created. Article number 2, humanism believes that man is a part of nature and that he has emerged as a result of a continuous process, evolution. Conclusion is these consequences to science, to the worldview. They lead people to develop religions called humanism and evolution and scientism that are against God and against the plain revelation of his creation. And for that cause, we should mourn and be humbled and seek to love and communicate the gospel. It's the only thing that will change the presupposition in this category. It's 11:30. I'm going to close. We have lunch at 11:45. Is that right? The schedule? Yes, 11:45. I'm early. All right. So some of you have nothing to say. But because I'm early, I thought I would do a little extra thing. So really quick, here we go. Well, I just got to show you this. You don't have to stay if you don't want to, but if you don't mind, I'm going to take you through just one little analysis. This is hot off the press as of yesterday, Scientific America. I want to show you this. I'm just showing you that I want to bring what we learn and apply it and test it. So here we go. This was an article not published yesterday, but I've just got it off the web yesterday. 15 answers to creationist nonsense. Scientific America. Here's the subtitle of the article by John Renee. He says this. Opponents of evolution want to make a place for creationism by tearing down real science, but their arguments don't hold up. Well, let's see if his argument holds up. This is his number three argument. I'll address the others in the after lunch. He says evolution is unscientific. He's saying this is what creationists claim and how we're wrong. Evolution is unscientific because it is not testable or falsifiable. It makes claims about events that were not observed and can never be recreated. So my thought is, if you sat through this last session and jumped on the web and came across this article, you might say, that is what he said. He said it's not science because it's not observable. And you might read the article and think, well, let's see. The article starts out, so actually pretty short. He starts out by this. These are his words, I quote, This blanket dismissal of evolution ignores important distinctions that divide the field into at least two broad areas, microevolution and macroevolution. Macroevolution looks at changes within species over time, changes that may be preludes to speciation and the origin of new species. You know what this is? This is a fallacy called the fallacy of equivocation. What he's doing is he answered the argument by equating two different terms, two different definitions. And what he does is he shifts basically the meaning of one word to the other. This is what he just did to you. He just said, well, we can see adaptation, microevolution. And then he throws in the second word, macroevolution, new speciation, as though if we can see it here, well, then it follows that it's also happening to new species. That's a fallacy. He didn't answer the charge. The charge was it's not observable. What's not observable? Adaptation? No, that's not the charge. The charge is speciation in your category, creating new fantastic features and new creatures. That's not answered. You didn't answer it. You looked at this example and you equivocated it to another, but you didn't answer. So I want to, again, help to see how we can test these things. The next thing he says, and I quote, macroevolution studies how taxonomic groups above the level of species change. Its evidence draws frequently from the fossil record and DNA comparisons to reconstruct how various organisms may be related. Interesting. Because what he's doing is he's not showing observation again. What he's answering now, this fallacy is called the converse accident or hasty generalization. What he just did is he was drawing a generalization from two few specific examples, namely DNA comparisons, which is not observable of macroevolution. It's only a conjecture, an inference based upon a subset that itself doesn't prove anything. You know, if you look at our DNA in cytochrome C, they try to claim that we're really close to the chimpanzee because we're like 97% percentage difference on cytochrome C. Wonderful. We're also 98% different from a yellow jacket. I don't see how that argument answers the issue. How did you create the human being? You didn't answer it, and you certainly didn't do it by this. All right, I think I'll have one or two more here. Evolution, he goes on, and I quote up here, evolution could be disproved in other ways. Now, I'm not doing this to make fun of, but this is laughable, okay, to call this science. He's saying, look, it could be disproved. It's falsifiable. How is it falsifiable? Look at how he explains evolution is falsifiable. If we could document the spontaneous generation of just one complex life form from inanimate matter, then at least a few creatures seen in the fossil record might have originated from this way. What is that? If we could prove spontaneous generation, then evolution would be disproved. What? What kind of circular reasoning is that? You need spontaneous generation to have evolution. And then you're going to say if we had it, then we could prove different creatures could come without evolution. That's ridiculous. And then he goes on. Watch this. If super intelligent aliens appeared and claimed credit for creating life on Earth, or even particular species, the purely evolutionary explanation would be cast into doubt. Oh. You're going to, really? So if Mr. Martian comes and actually tells you in the English language, no, I made that, you might doubt then. Unbelievable. But no one has yet produced such evidence. Listen, please follow the logic and see the fallacy. No one has produced the evidence, ergo, it's falsifiable. But it's not false. What? That's not logical. To say that I'm defending falsifiability because no one's proved it wrong is begging the question. Another fallacy. He is merely assuming what one is attempting to prove. And this is nothing less than an alien in the gaps Where did life come from? Sir Francis Bacon, the discoverer in 1953 of the DNA molecule. He says, when interviewed getting his Nobel Prize, he was asked point blank, so that molecule is pretty complex. Where do you think life came from? Well, we know it didn't originate on Earth. So where do you think it came from? I think aliens. That was the answer. And that's what's being documented. My last one. It should be noted that the idea of falsifiability as the defining characteristic of science. Now, let me stop you and just get the logic again. He just now tried to defend that it's falsifiable. And now he's going to move on and say, yeah, but falsifiability doesn't matter. It doesn't sound like he's too confident. It should be the idea of falsifiability as a defining characteristic of science originated with the philosopher Karl Popper. More recent elaborations of his thinking have expanded the narrowest interpretation of his principle precisely because it would eliminate too many branches of clearly scientific endeavor. That is circular reasoning. Purely circular. He's saying, no, this is scientific endeavor. And this method would eliminate this as scientific endeavor. Therefore, this cannot be the standard of science. What? We're trying to test if what you're saying is a standard of science. You can't make it the standard of science and then judge standards. And that's what you just did. That's circular reasoning, and it's also the no true Scotsman fallacy, which says that a term will be redefined to make your point. So this was an effort. Again, I really want everyone to get this. I'm not making fun of people. I am making fun of absurdity. And the thoughts and the ideologies, this is sad. These are people made in the image of God. They have worth, they have value and dignity, they have love and desire, and they need to know their Creator, and I pray to God that they would come to know Him. And we ought to be a people compassionate and desiring to see them repent and come to salvation in Christ. It's the only hope. It's nonsense apart from Him. It's unbelievable they write bold articles like this. Would you pray with me, please? And I'm going to pray for lunch, and you're free to go to lunch. Our Father in heaven, we do thank you for this day. We thank you for this time and opportunity to gather and to give our hearts and minds to meditate and consider a very serious matter that's before us. Again, the premises here are massive, and they're worthy of our complete embrace or complete rejection. So I pray that none of us would sit on the fence, that we would understand what's at stake, and that we would give our hearts to pursuing truth. I do pray, Father, for science as an endeavor among humanity, and I pray for the hearts of those who are thinking illogically and maintain a worldview that's unlivable. I pray that they would come to see their folly, and that by the grace and love of God, they would turn from their hopelessness and know what it means to have hope. I do pray for those present that you bless them, strengthen them, encourage their hearts, open their minds to see these things as wonderful and help them to apply them in their own thoughts, in their own worldview, and in how they communicate and interact with others. Our Lord God, you are the Creator of heaven and earth. We depend upon you every day for daily bread. We do ask, as our Lord has taught us, to give us this day our daily bread. We confess that we are needful and dependent. We ask that you would bless our bodies by it, that even through the molecules and the food, that our bodies would be nourished and strengthened physically. And that as we partake and enjoy the delight of taste and conversation, that you would bless our hearts to honor you with all that you give. You are worthy. You are glorious. Praise be to God. Amen.